for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters. We're back in the studio again.
Hey, everybody.
I'm Jamil Zainashev. I'm here with my good buddy and co-host, John Palmer, author of How to Brew, probably the finest book on learning how to brew. I tell you, a couple of people at work, they discovered that I'm into beer. And they go, so they all ask me, how do I learn how to brew? You know, what do I do? And I say, well, okay, step one, buy yourself a copy of this book, How to Brew, and, you know, read through the first few parts of it. You don't have to read the whole thing. Don't worry. There's a lot of stuff in there. I think the thing about How to Brew that might scare a new brewer off is that, it'll take you all the way through all grain. You know, it tackles some advanced topics. So no matter,
like a thick book, yeah.
Well, no matter where you are in the brew process. So when I first saw How to Brew, I already knew how to brew, and I got one. I think I won it as a prize at a competition. I started flipping through. I'm like, hey, I know how to brew. Hey, what's this guy going to tell me? I started flipping through it. I'm like, oh, it looks pretty interesting. And then I had a question one day. I don't know, mash temperatures or something. I'm like, well, I wonder if it's in there. Sure enough, it's in there. Like a water question one day. Wonder if it's in there. Sure enough, it's in there. You know, so I started saying, this is actually a really good book. There's a lot of stuff in here. If you're already an advanced brewer, I guarantee you there's still something in there that you don't know is in that book. And you will find cause to reference that book. And so I started giving out as gifts to a lot of my friends that I already brew, that people I'd brew with. I got a Christmas present for you. They're like, I know how to brew. It's like, trust me, you're going to find something in here that, I find this the best book on, answering a lot of the fundamental brewing questions. And I've found stuff in here that I didn't know. And they're like, oh, okay. You seem to know a lot about brewing. Sure. I'll give it a try. And, really fantastic. So I don't know why I'm raving about how to brew, but I really like it. Every time I start talking about it, I'm like, yeah, it's a really great book. So this one guy, this product manager where I work, he was like, I said, you don't have to read the whole thing, but he emailed or messaged me and he wanted to know. And I said, yeah, pick this up. Yeah, check it out. So he told me, like, the next day, he goes, okay, I read the entire book. I'm like, holy crap. I don't think I've read the entire book. And he goes, I'm really excited. It really made me even more interested in brewing. He says, I'm going down to Brewcraft in San Francisco for, I'm going to pick up my equipment. They're going to kind of give me a little lesson and kind of walk me through it. I'm thinking, perfect. They'll link up with a good homebrew shop and, read something like How to Brew. You don't have to read the whole thing. Read the parts that apply to you now, whatever stage you're at. And, link up with a good homebrew shop and get familiar with them. And, you'll be making great beer. Not just good beer, but great beer. Beer that, you feel like very proud to present to your friends. Beer, you feel like you can't buy in the store. Things like that. John, you got anything to say about maybe brewing classic styles?
I do. I mean, that brewing classic styles is hands down
awesome.
The best recipe book out there.
That's it? Wait a minute. I waxed eloquent for 15 minutes about how to brew.
It's okay.
It's got pages in it. Yeah.
There's this other book. It's got writing in it. Yeah, they tell you about some recipes.
No. I mean, I'm a man of few words. At least I try to be. And
yeah, we've read your book.
Yeah, Brewing Classic Styles is an awesome book. It's the best recipe book you can get. It explains more about what a recipe really consists of than any other book out there. So many recipe books are just a malt bill, and or you know, or just say, you know, this kind of yeast, but not how much. I mean, Brewing Classic Styles is the one that goes in depth and really gets you understanding what makes up the beer.
Surprised you can read Jamil's note card with his messy handwriting.
I had trouble finding the teleprompter.
That's weak, John. I don't know. I trust you for in-depth brewing knowledge, technical questions. But when it comes time to pimp a book and get people to buy it, I think you're leaving me here hanging high and dry. I don't know what the hell's going on.
Jamil, all of our friends know that I pimp you all the time.
Yeah. I do love my Johns.
On the street corner out there in Oakland.
I do love my Johns. I do.
All right, get on with it.
All right, so today I don't know what we're doing anymore.
And now for something completely different.
Yes, enzymes. Enzymes are a huge part of the brewing process. Even if you're not an all-grain brewer, enzymes have a big impact on extract brewers and any brewer. Brewing would not be possible, I think, without enzymes. So what we're going to do when we come back is we're going to get into... I'm sorry. I completely... I'm just having such a good time here. I neglected to mention we have Colin Kaminsky, master brewer at Downtown Joe's in Napa's, California. And he is probably one of the most knowledgeable people I know about every aspect of life, not just brewing.
Don't want you to feel like a third fiddle here,
yeah,
Colin.
He's here.
Keep on.
John got me so verklempt, that...
maybe you should let Palmer do it, Colin's plug.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a better plug than...
Just totally lost. But it's good to have you here in the studio. He knows everything about everything. And we also have one of the finest brewers I know, which is Tasty McDole.
Oh, glad to be here. Thanks.
I here by myself? Yeah. Does nobody understand what we're trying to do?
Can't you say a lot more about me than that?
I want to hear you wax for 15 minutes eloquently about Tasty.
Can we tell one of our old stories about the time you kicked my ass in some competition? Those are always good.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
The Man of Few Words show.
I can't see the cue cards.
Yeah, Man of Few Words kicks a host in the junk
show.
Thank you very much. All right,
I'm liking this.
After this break, we're going to come back and we're going to talk enzymes. We'll define it for you. We'll get into listener questions and everything you need to know about enzymes and brewing. Back after this.
Smart. Brew strong. This is Brew Strong. What's good for the earth, good for your body, and great for your brew? Organic ingredients. This holiday season, the organic ingredient experts, Seven Bridges Co-op in awesome Santa Cruz, California, offers you the gift that keeps on giving to our planet. Sustainable, fair wage ingredients to make the best organic homebrew you've ever had. There's a growing demand for organic products, and your choice to brew with them supports organic farmers worldwide. Brew organic, and you'll brew excellent beer that is free from chemical residues and genetically modified organisms, and you'll help contribute to a better world. If you're looking for organic ingredients, Seven Bridges offers a huge selection of USDA-certified kits and raw ingredients from 8 ounces to 50-pound sacks of grain, whole and pellet hops, and all the equipment you need. Seven Bridges, the organic homebrew expert since 1997. Visit www.breworganic.com.
What have you gotten out of a vial of White Labs yeast?
WLP-001, Cal Ale, baby!
23, Burton Ale.
008, East Coast Ale.
Cal Common, WLP-810.
It's gonna be WLP 400 with beer.
I got a sweet hoodie for my vial.
Huh?
White Labs, your source for great brewer's yeast, would like to invite all homebrewers to join the White Labs Customer Club. Redeem your empty vials for great White Labs merchandise and products. Free yeast, glassware, t-shirts, baseball caps, sweatshirts, polo shirts, and you won't believe what you'll get for 5,000 vials. Members also receive a newsletter packed with White Labs updates and facts, interviews with professional brewers, brew your own clone recipes, beercook.com recipes, and customer club stories. The White Labs Customer Club. Save your vials and get in the club. White Labs. It's all in the vial.
Did you know that every day a brewcaster goes to bed hungry? Did you know that that brewcaster is silently calling for the help of people just like you? Do you know that every day the unicorn and the rainbow have to blow sailors for loose change? For less than the cost of a half-calf, quad-shot, venti, extra-hot, soy milk, triple-pump, hazel, low-fat foam, double-cupped macchiato a day, you can help starving adults in Pacheco. Your love can be felt for as little as 7 cents a day. Visit thebrewingnetwork.com/donate to sign up today for as little as $2 a month. Private first class in the BN Army. Buy your way up the ranks as corporal, sergeant, ranger, or colonel with an easy-to-do monthly donation that keeps brewcasters alive and your favorite internet radio station broadcasting. No donation is too small to help those in need. Can't you find it in your heart to share your love with a brewcaster? In return, you will enjoy the wealth of knowledge that comes with every episode of The Session, The Jameel Show, and yes, even that other show. Thank you for listening, and please sign up for your donation at thebrewingnetwork.com/donate today.
This is www.thebrewingnetwork.com.
Sit down next to it, grab yourself a paper towel, and watch those yeast have sex.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
Back to your hosts, Jameel Zainasheff and John Palmer. Putting the testicles in technical, this is Brew Strong.
Oh yeah, we're talking enzymes on Brew Strong tonight. Our fantastic guest hosts here, Colin Kaminsky, Master Brewer, and Tasty McDowell, probably... I would consider you a master brewer of the amateur set.
Yeah, pretty much an amateur, yes. Pretty much.
Pretty much. Okay.
You know, I have a quick question for you before we get into enzymes, because I'm a little curious. What is the difference
between... What is
between
an enzyme?
What is the difference between a vitamin and a hormone? You can't make a vitamin.
Palmer likes that.
This is the problem when Tasty brings in beer. Everybody drinks way too much. Again, when the beer is really, really tasty, what happens is people drink way too much. And if the beer is not so good, then people don't drink as much. So if you've noticed people drinking a lot of your beer, it's probably really good.
Yeah.
This is the problem.
Or your friends are just stupid, you know.
Weird senses of humor. Okay. I think the show has gotten out of control for me. I think I've lost my grip on
So what you wanted to say was, what are enzymes?
No. What I wanted to say is Mason emailed us, and he said, I'm having a problem with fermentability of the LME I'm getting, specifically the pills. I've never tried extracting enzymes before, but I'm going to try making the Dortmunder export from the book, and I was hoping for some tips to get the most out of my process. Do I dissolve the LME in 6 gallons of water? The LME is liquid malt extract. In 6 gallons of water, and then steep some 2-row at 149 Fahrenheit for some amount of time. How long? I don't know. Okay, so when I got this email, I was thinking to myself, God, I get way too many emails to answer. And then I said to myself, okay, I got to send him an answer, but I think the answer I need to give him is something about enzymes. I don't think he understands exactly, you know, the role of enzymes, what they are, things like that. He's like, I'm going to try extracting enzymes. I've never heard anybody phrase it that way before. So not that Mason is somehow less intelligent than the rest of us, but he's new to this, and so there are some misconceptions that happen when you're new to brewing. So
let's actually just start from the beginning. Where do enzymes come from? Right. And in fact,
let's start even early. What is an enzyme?
Well, I'll venture a wild-ass guess of a way to think about it. And this is, not as technically correct as it is a good way to think about it. And imagine this really big, long, stringy thing, and we'll call it a molecule, for lack of a better word. And it changes its shape very rapidly in a way that we might call vibration. And what it has this amazing ability to do is grab on to other molecules, and we're going to call those maltose or sugars or starches or anything that we're concerned with reducing, and as a catalyst to cleaving them into smaller pieces. Mm-hmm. And once it's done cleaving it, it lets go until it grabs onto something else. So a little tiny bit of enzyme goes a long ways, because what it does is it catalyzes, it grabs onto something, it does its job, and it lets go. It's not expended in the process.
It doesn't get used up. It's
like a chemical key.
So you can get more cleavage. I love cleavage.
I love cleavage, too. Yeah.
So, the more cleavage, the better.
Where was that fluff girl again?
But John, you're saying it's like a key?
It's like a chemical key. It's a catalyst. It's a protein that acts as a catalyst in reactions and acts like a chemical key. And I agree with Colin's assessment.
So it's in the genetic code for barley, but barley's really smart. Okay, so there's lots of little organisms, like, let's say, yeast, that barley's trying to protect itself from. And so in order to protect itself, what it does is it hides all of its food sources as starch, because yeast can't eat starch. Well, as a brewer, we want to eat starch and make it into sugars so that our yeast can eat it. And the barley plant, when it's growing, also wants to be able to eat that starch.
It uses that starch to get itself growing. It converts
to
into
make
sugars.
That first little sprout. Mm-hmm. And the only way it can do that is to convert that starch to sugar. So it's stored in the shape of starch simply to protect itself from bioorganisms. And in the genetic code of the barley also has the DNA that makes the enzyme that unlocks all of that starch. So it's actually a really smart way of protecting itself from the organisms that we're going to try to feed it to.
It turns that starch into sugars that makes the wort that we use to make the beer.
And fortunately, we've got this really brilliant person in our lives that we never sing his praises, and that's the maltster. Mm. And we're
talking about me, but that's okay. That's all right.
We pretend like as brewers we're the only people that make beer, but the truth of the matter is our allied trade is maltsters, and maltsters do half of the work for us, or maybe even more of the work. And what they do is they take that little tiny piece of DNA, they soak it in water, they let that kernel sprout, which activates that whole enzyme package, and then they hold it at a high enough temperature that it stops growing and literally kills that seed, but doesn't denature that enzyme.
To dry it out, yep.
To dry
Stop
it out.
The process.
And
yep.
And so we have, when we get the barley, it's called malted barley, because the maltster's already had it, and we get that nice little enzyme package perfectly stored with the starch that we need. And it's our jobs as brewers now to activate that enzyme package and get it working on that starch. And that's what we call mashing.
So we do that by getting it wet at a certain temperature.
At the temperature that activates the enzyme we want, which there's a bunch of enzymes we can choose.
And crushing the grain, which
exposes the starch to the water, right?
To the water and to the enzymes. And the enzymes work on that starch and turn it into sugars.
Or work on the proteins and reduce it to simple amino acids. So if we activate protease enzymes at a lower temperature, we can actually take some protein out of the malts. Now, that's not so important anymore, but 100 years ago, if you didn't do that, you weren't brewing.
So how many different enzymes are there in barley malt?
100.
103.
Yeah, no, there's a lot. I mean, there's several major classes.
Uh-huh.
But within a class such as the protease and the peptidases, you have another 20, 30, 40 different ones that all belong to that group. And collectively, their proteases, and this enzyme may work best at a pH of 5 and a temperature of 130. This other enzyme in that same group may work better at a pH of 4.5 and a temperature of 120. There's a lot of different ones within a group. But there's 7-8 major classes.
And of all of these, are they all active when you're brewing, when you mash?
They're all active to some extent, but as Colin said, there's lots of, or each enzyme has a particular range where it's most active, where it's optimum activity. And then once you go above that range, enzymes are denatured by heat.
Which means they fall apart. We vibrated them so much that they actually shake themselves to pieces.
Yeah, they straighten out and they don't fit the lock anymore.
And you can't get them back.
So in different enzymes, that happens at different temperatures, right? So
right.
Those lower temperature enzymes maybe get
like
denatured.
Like a protease at a... Well, I don't know about that. I know at 170 something they all denature.
They all denature? Okay.
Yeah. But I don't know if I'm assuming they all have different denaturing temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
But we
That's
use
right.
them in brewing. We tend to use them from the cold side on. So if you want to use a colder one, you utilize it until you're done with it, and then you warm it up until the next one becomes mm-hmm. active.
Well, here's an interesting question that I got in from Michael, and he was saying, Jamel, I'm trying to shave some time off my brew day. He set up this electric hot liquor tank and this whole thing, and he was going to try and get the whole process going while he was still sleeping, and when he woke up in the morning, he'd be set. He said, I'll set the thermostat to a reasonable mash temp, say 66 degrees C, and I'll set a timer on the circuit to kick in prior to me waking on brew day. In theory, I'd like to wake up and have the mash converted and ready to lauter. Now, I reckon as long as we get a reasonable heat transfer, I may even add a mash stir to the rig so that the heat evenly distributes better. All that will work just fine. He said, my problem is that I can see that I need to add the water to the grain the evening prior. Now, let's say the tap water comes through at 25 degrees C. Then the mash will end up sitting for, say, 8 hours around that temp of 25 degrees C before rising to mash temperature over a period of about an hour. Now, I like the fact that it passes through all temperatures of enzyme activity between 25 and 66 degrees C over the hour, like an infinite step mash, sort of. But I am really worried about what impact the extended soak for 8 hours at 25 degrees C will have on the mash. Any idea what might happen in that soak period?
Yeah, you're going to grow lactobacillus.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, there's just no way to control the pH in that situation. So, minutes at the right temperature, you'll grow lactobacillus. And certainly over a long period of time, lactobacillus contaminates all malt. And you will grow lactobacillus if you just leave it soaking.
Even at 25C?
Yeah.
Not as fast as mm-hmm. if it were a little warmer, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, body temperature up to 110. Yeah, you'll grow lots of it.
And let's say for somehow you didn't have to worry about lactobacillus. What happens with the enzymes?
They still function. Mm-hmm.
Are you getting any enzyme activity at 25 degrees C?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is one of my favorite experiments. People wanted to figure out what their conversion rate was, so a bunch of homebrewers got together and they decided, okay, well, we're all going to mash at different temperatures, and then we're going to take that wort and store it. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to measure how much sugars we converted. Well, of course, by the next day when everyone measured it, even though everything was cold, 100% conversion had happened. Because, in the course of hours, the amylase enzymes will convert all the sugar.
Yeah.
So these enzymes, we talk about them only being effective, say, for amylase, we say, from 142 to 158F. Mm-hmm. You've got the alpha and beta amylase is active. But the truth of the matter is they're active much colder. They just work so much slower that they're not useful to us at those right. temperatures.
Well, and Damon, he wrote in and he said, hey, I brewed your best bitter yesterday. And that's obviously from the Brewing Classic Styles book.
Which book was that? That one that just had a bunch of pages.
It's the Awesome Recipe Book, yes.
Brewing Classic Styles book, which you can pick up, which is authored by John Palmer and myself. You can pick up in the Brewing Network store. Go to thebrewingnetwork.com, click on the store. You find the Brewing Classic Styles, or you can even get it signed. And
I should have brought my copy in to get it signed, actually.
And if you're international and you want to order it overseas, then you can get it from the AHA Direct.
They don't even read it. You know, they end up, these are book stops, books, door stops, people's toilets. I'm just distressed. All right, so he says, hey, I brewed your best bitter yesterday. I got interrupted right after the sparge. It started raining heavily, so I pulled everything into the garage and went out for dinner. Basically, the wort set covered for about 2.5 hours. I figured since it gets boiled anyways, everything ought to be okay.
No, there are mass spoilage organisms, and you don't run into them much in normal processes, but they're pretty vile. Yeah.
And he had sparged. So it's sitting in the kettle, and those same organisms can spoil, make it vomity, things like that. One of the things, enzyme related, let's talk enzymes, right? If he had done a mash out step and gotten the temperature to a point where it denatures the enzymes, as far as fermentability of the wort, it would have remained the same.
It would have locked in, yeah.
If he did not do that... If let's say he was mashing at 152 and then just ran it off and his sparge water was somewhere in the 150s Fahrenheit, and then let that sit in the kettle and it started to cool down, does not beta amylase become more active, and wouldn't this affect the fermentability of the wort?
Well,
it would, but
and this is the thing we should talk about alpha and beta amylase, which is really important to understand. Is once alpha amylase has had its round at the sugars, beta amylase can't go back and reduce it simpler. And the reason for that is beta amylase needs to have two rings to hold on to before it can start cleaving. I think maybe it's even three rings before it can start cleaving off sugars. So alpha amylase just goes in and starts cleaving randomly. So what happens is when you use alpha amylase, you end up with a much less fermentable wort, because what's going on is it leaves all these random shapes that beta amylase can't reduce any further.
Mm-hmm.
It just goes in and cuts randomly anywhere. But beta amylase
has to... That's where limodextrinase comes in.
Beta amylase has to start at... let's get back to that. Beta amylase has to start at one end and work its way all the way down the starch chain.
Yeah, beta amylase works like a hedge trimmer. It takes the tips off, and the limodextrinase works on the odd joints of both the alpha and beta. And as Colin says, the alpha clips randomly around the chain on the straight sections, kind of like taking off twigs.
So the limodextrinase, that's at active at what temperature, and the effect is?
What it does is it's active at the same temperature range as the alpha and beta, from about 60 to 65 C or 140-150 F. Beta amylase and limodextrinase are both denatured as you get above 150 degrees. Limodextrinase lasts a little bit longer than the beta amylase. So let's say you're doing a single temperature infusion mash at 155. You're over this denaturing temperature. One study I wrote, a paper in the journal, noted that the beta amylase is reduced to 75% of its original activity after 30 minutes at 150 F. So at 155, that would be a little bit more, a little bit faster. It'd probably be down to about 40% of its original activity after 30 minutes at 155. So when we talk about doing step mashes, we're talking about optimizing or giving more time for the lower temperature beta amylase to work before we ramp up and get more activity out of the alpha amylase. There's a whole bunch of things I can talk about here, and I don't know where to start. Let me pause there and make sure we've answered this first question.
Well, one thing that Bob Hansen at Breese had told me when dealing with extracts is, you know, you're not necessarily locked into the fermentability of a given extract. If you get that extract and you can add some more grain to it, some more, which will have more enzymes, and the enzymes can have an effect on the sugars that are in that extract and actually make them more fermentable. Is that not the case?
That is true. You can use a diastatic malt extract that has active enzymes in it. You can add malt extract to your mash. And
you can buy industrial enzymes as well.
That's true. You can buy, you know, alpha amylase and beta amylase enzymes. And as you mentioned earlier, Jamil, when you simply, you know, run off to the boil kettle without doing a mash out, you know, if that wort is still like 155, the alpha is still active and it'll continue cleaving any residual starches. You know, if conversion wasn't, you know, 100% at the end of your mash, it'll continue working on the larger sugars in that wort, and you know, you can end up with a much more fermentable wort than what you had originally planned. But it's the beta amylase that makes the maltose. It's the sole function of that enzyme is to make the 2-glucose sugar called maltose, which is your prime brewing sugar, and it's you know, completely fermentable. Alpha amylase makes a variety of sugars. You know, makes maltose, it makes glucose, it makes maltotriose and maltotetriose, as well as oligosides. Oligosides are anything larger than the 4-unit maltotriose or maltotetriose. And that's where limit dextrinase comes in. Limit dextrinase is like the third wheel here. It breaks up what we call the limit dextrins that result from these random, you know, cleavings of the starch molecules. Both the alpha and beta amylase can't break. If you envision a starch as like a tree branch, it can't break the joint. It can't cut the chain of the joint. It only can cut it on a straight section. In the case of beta, it cuts it right at the tip. In the case of alpha, it can cut it anywhere there's a straight section. But limit dextrinase can go in and separate it at the joint. And so that's why we, you know, when we do a step mash to encourage fermentability, we do a low temperature rest, say in the 140 to 150 range, where you're not denaturing the beta amylase and the limit dextrinase so much, and we make lots of maltose. But we'll reach a limit on the amount of maltose we can make. After that, you know, you run into these limit dextrins, and then you need to raise the temperature, and alpha amylase, you know, becomes more active at a slightly higher temperature, 155, 158, and it will succeed in cleaving off more of those starches into larger sugars that the remaining beta amylase and the remaining limit dextrinase can break down into smaller, more fermentable sugars.
Well, and we'll do shows in the future about the specific temperatures and trying to achieve more fermentable worts and less fermentable worts and various things like that. But I find this all very fascinating. And one of the things that I learned not too long ago about enzymes and starches is, let's say you take rice. Right. A lot of times people go, I want lots of maltose in my beer. I don't want to use rice or corn or any of those other starches. Right. If you use rice and you use, you know, barley enzymes, you're going to get maltose.
Yeah,
because it's the maltose is the sugar that's created by the enzymes that are breaking down the starch. It doesn't matter that the starch came from rice; it's still making maltose. So when you say, "Well, you know, I don't want any of those because I want maltose," well, rice can be turned into maltose.
Absolutely,
all these different sugars. I guess any starch could, right?
Yeah, any starch. Distillers even take potatoes and turn it into fermentables.
And it could be maltose. You could take a potato.
They could take it all the way to maltose.
It's based on the enzyme. The enzyme determines what kind of sugar you get. It's not the starch.
Right. And to get that enzyme, you have to have the temperature, the pH, and the concentration right as well. And, you know, that's what worries me a little bit about people, like, they want to, say, take 10 gallons of an extract beer and put a pound of barley in there, crushed barley, and utilize the enzymes out of it. You've diluted the enzymes so much at that point that they're not as effective. Mm-hmm. So it takes a lot longer than we think about mashing-wise. You know,
that's true.
If I just change, you know, my grist to grain, my grist to water ratio in my mash tun, I change how fast my mash mm-hmm. takes it by the little tiny bits. And you go make a big change, like dropping it into the boil, uh-huh. then suddenly you're making a big change.
Well, and I got a question just about that. And so one point I wanted to make on the rice and potatoes and other starches is they do not have the same. There's other flavors that come from barley.
Yes.
And it's not related to the maltose sugars. It's related to a lot of other things. So, yes, rice will have, you know, a different flavor, but again, you're still producing maltose, and that's a function of the enzyme. The key that John was talking about, as far as unlocking the starches and turning them into sugars.
Yes.
The sugar it produces when you're using these barley enzymes is maltose, and a lot of the rice syrups that you can get are maltose. Sugars. There's like 90% maltose sugars, is my understanding.
I use maltose that's derived from corn mm-hmm. to dry beers out all the time.
There you go. All right, so Cameron had written in. He said, for practical reasons, I've usually been going with enough water to reach my false bottom, and then I add an additional 1.2 quarts per pound of grain. A friend of mine seems to think I'm using too much water, but cannot articulate why it's detrimental to my beer. The only real argument I found for using less water is that the enzymes do not have to travel as far to find starch, but with modern malting methods producing modified grain with more than enough enzymes, is that even an issue? And if it is, wouldn't a few extra minutes of mash time solve it? You know, myself, I do the exact same thing. I fill the void under my false bottom, and then I use 1.3 quarts per pound. So I'm using even more water than this guy. Did I have something to worry about? Are my beers not going to turn out right? What's going on?
No. You're right in the ideal range. Yeah.
So that water, that foundation water that goes under the false bottom, that's not a problem?
No.
No,
and the water that you put on top to sparge as well is not an issue, or to recirculate. If you, I don't like the top of the grain bed to get dry because I think that's a bigger issue. So I'll actually throw a couple inches layer of water on the top as well, and that doesn't dilute my enzymes enough for it to be an issue.
If you look at the professional breweries around the world, they're usually brewing with grist ratios of 3-1, and a lot of times even up to 4-1. That would be liters per kilogram, which is equivalent to 1.5 quarts per pound to 2 quarts per pound, and even slightly more, 2.5 quarts per pound.
Especially if they're pumping the mash, in order to use a traditional lager tun, you have to pump the mash.
Well,
so then you're getting even thinner.
Yeah. One of my understanding is that the thicker mash favors longer chain sugars or less fermentable wort, and the thinner mash favors more fermentable sugars. Is that true? So there is an effect. It's minor.
There is an effect.
It's minor.
A small effect.
And it's not even worth worrying about because you can adjust your temperature. And
exactly. Well, and your temperature is probably not very well controlled in a home brewery. You know, when I measure when I measure the temperature on the edge of a homebrew mash tun, and uh-huh. I measure the temperature in the center, I get drastically different temperatures.
Well, and one thing I'm curious about, Palmer, I think when I got a question like this, I turn to you because I'm sure you got the answer. Can you list off for me what are all the different types of enzymes that we're going to be using or that affect us brewing-wise? Can you give us a list of those, a rundown?
Sure. The first one is beta-glucanase, and it's a low-temperature enzyme. It's active between room temperature and like 120 degrees. Its preferred temperature range is like body temperature to 110, And what it does is it breaks down the gums in the grain. It breaks down the cellulose in the gums. It helps a lot with the viscosity, the thickness of the mash, makes it more fluid, more. You can have lautering difficulties if you have a lot of beta glucan in your mash.
But fortunately, our maltsters deal with that for us, so the average person doesn't have to worry about that.
That's right. You know, that's a primary purpose of malting, is to break up both the protein to carbohydrate matrix that the starches are locked in, as well as breaking up these gums, the beta glucans that would make the mash really thick and make it very difficult to work with. Wheat has a lot of beta glucan, and that's the gumminess in the dough. And the purpose of malting, like I said, is to break that up. So that's not a problem. When you mash, you don't end up making a big tub of dough. You make mash. It's much looser
and clear.
So that's your beta glucanase. Next, you have your proteases and your peptidases. Those are your protein enzymes. Your proteases take what we refer to as a very large insoluble protein and cleave it down to a smaller, more soluble protein. It's also the enzyme that contributes to your head retention, and it's also the enzyme that contributes to your haze. It produces those haze size proteins, and the head retention proteins are very similar in size. Peptidases are what make your free amino nitrogen, your peptides, your amino acids, and you can kind of compare them to alpha and beta amylase. Your protease, takes the large proteins and makes them a little smaller, kind of like alpha amylase. It takes the large starch and breaks it down into a variety of larger sugars, whereas your beta amylase takes that starch and makes small, very small sugars. Same way your peptidase takes these proteins and cleaves off very small peptides and amino acids. Now, both of those protein enzymes are both active in the same temperature range, from room temperature up to 150 F. They're both active throughout that range. Their preferred range is at the warmer end, typically 115 to 130 degrees Fahrenheit or 45 to 55 C. And you really can't differentiate between them in your mash. You can't, accentuate, the fan enzyme over the head retention enzyme or vice versa. It's kind of like when you throw something in the blender and hit puree a couple times, you hit it once really quick, you can break it up, but if you hit it for any length of time, it's going to turn it to paste. It's not very controllable with that. And that, 100 years ago when we were using less modified malts, you needed a protein rest, and you needed the protein rest to break up the protein carbohydrate matrix that holds onto the carbohydrates that we're trying to, get our extract from. That's our sugars. You needed the protein rest to break that open, to further modify that malt and make those starches accessible. Nowadays, with highly modified malts, we don't need the protein rest to do that.
And actually, now a protein rest can even be detrimental to beer quality.
That's right, because there's nothing else for it to act on except those head retention and haze proteins. So it's, maybe a short protein rest may be useful if you're trying to build fan into your wort. If you're using a lot of adjuncts like rice or corn that doesn't have much fan or much protein in it, then a short protein rest can help build that back up. But, it's like a blender. If you do it too long, you just make mush.
And you end up with no head retention.
That's right. Then you come to your amylase enzymes or your sacrification enzymes, the beta amylase, the alpha amylase, and the limit dextrinase. And as I was saying earlier, the beta amylase is denatured above 150 F or 65 C, and it prefers the 140 to 150 range. So that when we do a step mash, we'll do a rest like at 145 or 150 C, 150 F for a period of time to make lots of maltose. But then we reach a limit and we need to ramp up into the region where that alpha amylase prefers, which is like 140 to 167 F or 60 to 75 C, and let that break down those large sugars and those large starches further. And there's one other thing I wanted to touch on, that in all of this enzyme activity, the thing we're kind of forgetting is that you need to have the starches accessible to the enzymes. And the way you do that is they have to become solubilized or gelatinized, as we call it. And each starch has its own gelatinization temperature. Now, barley gelatinizes between 140 and 150 degrees Fahrenheit, or 60 to 65 C. So if you think about it, when you're doing your beta amylase rest, maybe only 50% of your starches have become soluble at that point. And so you're going to make, you know, a lot of maltose with the starches that are available to the beta amylase, but there's still a proportion of those starches that aren't soluble yet. And that's why you need to ramp up to like 155, get above that starch gelatinization temperature range, complete the solubilization, and now all the enzymes can have access to the starches and really break them down. That's for barley, 140 to 150. Wheat and rye and oats have lower gelatinization temperatures, so does oats. Oats is like 127 to 138 F. Wheat is 136 to 147 F. Corn and rice, corn is 143 to 165 F. So when you see recipes that call for corn, it'll be like flake corn or grits that they tell you to cook first before you add them to the mash, and that's because you need to bring them above 165F to complete that solubilization so that those starches will be accessible to the enzymes.
UC Davis, when you brew in their pilot system, or at least the older pilot system that they had, part of your requirement for making a brew was actually to convert some rice into its gelatinized state and then extract the sugars from it. Now, of course, that's because Anheuser-Busch pays for most of that program. But every batch of beer involved taking that little steam kettle, a little 2 or 3 gallon steam kettle that you would actually gelatinize rice in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, rice has the highest temperature of the common grains. It's 154 to 172. So you really do got to cook that stuff first before you can try to use it in the mash.
Yeah, and that's what they would do, is they would cook it and then they'd put it in the mash.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So
and funny thing is, I have a question about that very thing. And what we'll do is, when we come back from this break, we'll answer a couple more email questions and we'll get into live chat and wrap this up right after this.
Keep your carboy cap on. This is Brew Strong. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sean O'Sullivan, the brewmaster and co-founder of the 21st Amendment Brewery and Restaurant in San Francisco. 6 years ago, Nico Freccia and I opened the 21st Amendment on 2nd Street with the intent of bringing back the local neighborhood brew pub. Well, the neighborhood has really changed over the years, but the 21st Amendment still remains a great place for people to meet over a terrific meal and a tasty pint of beer. In the past, the only way you could enjoy the 21st Amendment's handcrafted beers was at the brew pub. Well, all that has changed. Now, the 21st Amendment beers are available in cans. That's right, cans. When was the last time you had a great beer in a can? Well, that day has come. We're offering our world-famous Watermelon Wheat and 21A IPA in cans. Cans are a better package than glass because cans keep the beer fresher longer, but you can also take cans to places where bottles can't go, like the beach, lake, golf courses, and sporting events. So join us in the revolution to take back the can from the big breweries and crack open a cold 21A craft beer in a can. The 21st Amendment, 563 2nd Street in San Francisco, just two blocks from Giants Park.
Williams Brewing is your online resource for prompt delivery of quality home brewing supplies. Since 1979, Williams Brewing has offered the finest equipment and freshest ingredients and the best customer service in the business. Cut hours off your brewing sessions by using one of their 11 varieties of famous Williams malt extract. Their Williams German Pils is mashed with pure German Moravian two-row barley malt for a light blonde color and malty Christmas you just can't get from other extracts. Or check out their unique fermenters, draft beer equipment, bottling aids, and more. They even have their own line of precision hydrometers. Go to williamsbrewing.com to browse their vast selection and enter promo code BREW at the order checkout for $5 off your next order over $50. Orders placed by 3 p.m. ship the same day. Again, go to williamsbrewing.com and enter promo code BREW at checkout for $5 off your next order. Brewing is easy the Williams way.
Live. Beer Radio. The Brewing Network.
The Brewcasters.
If you're just starting, don't be discouraged by all this stuff. Exactly. It's so easy.
Just throw it together.
Put some sugar and some water and some yeast in there.
Yeah.
Like the Lance Armstrong of the beer world. Except for that nut thing.
This is Brew Strong.
Okay, we're talking enzymes here with my good friends, John Palmer, Colin Kaminsky, and Tasty McDowell. Well, Michael Tasty McDowell.
What?
What?
I have a new name?
Mike.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. See,
my mother.
But I call him Tasty all the time, so
yeah.
I've gotten so used to it that I just say Tasty. Yeah, well, I think it's one of the coolest nicknames we have. Jim had emailed us, and he said, I listen to the MP3 of the Jamel Show on the Classic American Pilsner. The Jamel Show can be listened to on the Brewery Network. It airs every other Monday opposite the Brew Strong Show. If you haven't checked that out, it's where we cover all sorts of different styles and get into a lot of details. That's a great show, too. Of course, cause, you know, well, all right, well, I won't get into that. In the bit where you're discussing the cereal mashing of the polenta, I understood you say that you're taking polenta, adding water, heat on a mash schedule. Don't you have to add some 6-row or something with enzymes to convert the starch in the corn to fermentables? Otherwise, you're just gelling the polenta as opposed to converting starches. Can't you just go to a boil and not worry about the step temperatures? Essentially, I think there was a little miscommunication there. You have to boil the snot out of it to break up the starches, right? Get those accessible to the enzyme.
Yeah.
And then you add it back to your mash where all those enzymes are at. And I don't quite understand the whole part of throwing some grain in with your cereal mash.
I
but
do.
I know that's the John does. There you go.
Yeah, you can get that starch broken down by a combination of enzymes and heat, or heat alone. In a professional brewery setting, where they're like in Budweiser or Miller, where they're making, you know, trying to boil the snot out of, you know, hundreds of pounds of of corn or rice, it saves energy to use some enzyme activity there as well, because it breaks down sooner. You don't have to boil it as long.
But the enzymes in the grain, you know, once you get past 170 degrees, don't you end up denaturing the enzymes once you get past a certain temperature? So once you're boiling anyways, it's like useless, right?
Right, but you
take it up
slowly.
Them up to boil.
You do what's called a cereal mash,
mm-hmm.
where you start out at a beta amylase kind of rest. With your polenta and your enzymes in there, and the enzymes, the barley enzymes, will work on the surface of the starches and start breaking them down. And so mm-hmm. you'll take it through that mash regime, and you can get half of it. Throwing out a number, you can get half of it broken down and solubilized before you go through the boil.
And they're actually running it up to temp as fast as they can. It's just there's enough time. It takes that long to do it that mm-hmm. that the enzymes have some time to be active.
Well, Colin, you've hung around these types of brewers that use these adjuncts, and any other thoughts on when you're using these adjuncts and doing these cereal mash?
Boy, I buy it all pre-gelatinized. I buy it flaked because mm-hmm. it's so much easier just to buy it flaked. It doesn't cost, you know, cost pennies more per pound, which doesn't make any difference to you or me.
The process of going through the rollers, it's high temp and it's slightly moist, and it gelatinizes when it goes through the rollers and makes those flakes, so it's ready to add right to your mash.
And it has a huge amount of surface area, so the enzymes go right after it.
Yeah, you don't need to run it through your mill or anything. You just throw it in there. I run it through the mill anyways. But
I do because my mill is upstairs, and that mm-hmm. means it saves me from throwing it on my back and carrying mm-hmm. it downstairs.
Well, and it mixes it throughout, and you know, instead of just piling it on top. And
yeah, the only thing I don't run through my mill anymore is...
Small kittens?
I try to stop that, but, you know, the thrill of it is just so exciting.
it's the screams that really work for you, right?
The powders that you might use in a brewery, I don't run through the mill because they end up sticking in the grain, you know, in the flue. Mm. So I use dextrose, I use maltodextrin, both to change fermentability aspects of the beer.
Mm-hmm.
And those don't go through the mill. Everything else that comes out of the grain room goes through the mill, though. Dark malts, flaked, I don't care.
Well, John, I got one here from Fred, and he said there was a post in the More Beer Forum, supposedly quoting John Palmer, that suggested that setting the hot liquor tank high enough to raise or maintain the mash temperatures. This is on a system with a Herms or a Rims system where it recirculates the liquid from the mash through a coil and heats it up to maintain the temperature of the mash or to do a step mash to raise it. He said that the temperatures would denature the enzymes that you were trying to utilize. On my system, I have set the hot liquor tank 10 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit above the desired mash temperature to keep the temp up during the rest, i.e. 163 on his hot liquor temp to get 153 stable Fahrenheit in his mash. Is this messing up the rests?
But it could, you know, just logically. I mean, if you think about, you know, you're taking the wort and it contains your enzymes and heating up above your mash temperature. Yeah, you could be denaturing your beta amylase. But, you know, when you think about, okay, you're only heating up a portion of the wort, you have the rest of the enzymes in the mash, you're gradually heating up the rest of the mash with this recirculation, most of your enzymes will be preserved. But it's, and so, you know, in response to that, or as part of that suggestion, what I advocate is, you know, monitoring the outflow temperature of the wort out of the Herms. So, you know, you can see how hot that wort got while it was going through the coils in the hot liquor tank. And, you know, if you see that wort exiting your hot liquor tank is 175, 180 degrees, you know, if your hot liquor tank is that hot, you know, that's probably defeating the purpose, because you are probably denaturing more enzymes or denaturing the enzymes as fast as you're heating your mash. But if it's something like, if you've set it to 165 or 170 and the wort exiting the Herms coil is maybe at 160, well, it's not that high. You've denatured a portion of the enzymes, and then that's feeding back into the main mash and cooling down again to like 150. And so as the whole mash gradually comes up to this set temperature, you've preserved a lot of your enzyme potential.
You know, when I built a Herm system, what I did was I actually took that output temperature and used it to set my hot liquor burner. So if I wanted that, if my next step was 150F, then what I would do was put my thermal probe on the output of the wort coming out of the Herms, and I would turn the burner on until my wort was coming out of the Herms at 150F, and when it was, the burner would shut off.
Yeah.
And that was how I dealt with all of that, and it actually dealt with both issues at once, and it was actually really controllable.
Yeah, that's how I'm building my RIMS system. I'm building a RIMS that uses a direct-fired mash tun, and I'm drawing the wort out from under the false bottom there in the mash tun, and recirculating it on top of the mash. And but my temperature controller is that controls the flame is looking at that exit temperature of the wort coming out from under the false bottom. So I'm never going to exceed my set temperature. It's just going to circulate until the whole mash and the wort it's seen is, it exceeds that set temperature, and then it'll shut off.
The only problem I've ever seen with direct fire on a mash tun is if whatever feet hold the screen up trap grain underneath it, it scorches.
Oh, yeah.
And as long as you've taken care of that, like hold it onto the sides of the wall, heating up the mash tun's a really fun thing to play with.
Yeah, that's the way I've been doing it.
All right. Bill wrote in, and if you listen to either the podcast or live, you can email us at brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com, and that way you can get your questions answered on the air, just like Bill did, and John and I and the rest of the crew will dig into your questions and give you some detailed answers. In this case, Bill was asking, I want to brew an extract version of your Scottish 60-shilling recipe. Again, that recipe would be from Brewing Classic Styles.
Have you written a book, Jimmy?
Maybe I should bring some of my emails in. I don't have a book, and they're much more varied.
And they'll say, in Jamel's book.
Yeah.
According to Fred Bonjour's website, Fred has a great website with a lot of awards.
Yeah, I have a recipe there, yes. Yeah, you may want to check that out. If you're tired of those 80 award-winning recipes,
I think
a few other award-winning recipes.
We're not going to call you Tasty anymore. I think we're going to call you Testy. Testy yeah. McDole.
Yeah. Well, there was something about this show being testicle-oriented.
Yes. I can say, okay, wait. Completely off the rails.
Oh, okay.
You know, I can swear to God right here, right now, Jamil only has one testicle. The advertisement is wrong.
Yes.
I don't know where this is going yet. That nut thing. I can substitute the pale malt with extract. I want to brew it. I got to read this again.
Yeah,
I want to brew an extract version of Scottish 60-shilling recipe. According to Fred Bonjour's website, I can substitute pale malt with extract. Given the remaining grains, Munich especially, I believe that a partial mash will be required. Can I simply do a partial mash with the remaining grains, Munich, honey, Crystal 40, Crystal 120, and chocolate? Or do I need to throw in some pale malt to provide enzymes for conversion? Who wants to tackle that one?
I will. The diastatic power, that is the measure of the how much amylase enzyme is in the malt, for Munich malt, it's only about 40 compared to two rows, 120, 130 for diastatic power.
For U.S. two row.
Pardon?
For U.S. two row.
Yeah. Europeans can be
much
can
lower.
Be higher.
Yeah. The one I get is 60 to 80, so it's much lower. Yeah.
What do you say, European? What are you saying?
I use
European two row or
Pilsner? European two row.
Okay. Yeah.
I use crisp Maris Otter. And
okay, yeah.
It's very low.
That's a pale ale malt, right?
Yeah, it's a little heavier than the crisp pale malt.
Okay.
It's a little darker.
Yeah. The kilning that those malts go through denatures some of the enzymes. So, yeah, 60 to 80 is about right for a pale ale malt or for this two row, the crisp. And I guess no one publishes, what the minimum amount of enzymes you need in the mash is for full conversion, but they do say that a Munich malt at 40 will convert itself,
but not in the adjuncts.
Enough time.
Right, it can't convert the other things.
Right, you wouldn't want to put rice in with all Munich malt.
So things like Munich malt, Vienna malt, aromatic. You could take 100% aromatic malt. It'll self convert. Make a mash out of that and see what 100% aromatic malt beer would taste like.
Yuck.
But the thing is that the darker kiln the malt is, the more the enzymes have been denatured, and the less ability to self convert or convert other grains would be.
And I guess we're getting towards
that,
this really
that
important
comes
point,
in, right?
Yeah, we're getting to this really important point backwards. And what's really important is what John's saying, and that is there is a measure of how much amylase is left in the malt. And you can look it up on your malt analysis. I assume that somewhere around 30, 35, if I average all my malts together by their weight, that I'm going to start running into issues. And that as long as I'm somewhere in there, that I'm going to convert just fine. But you start... I don't ever add extracts, so if you start out with a bunch of extracts and then you go dilute all your enzymes, I don't know how that behaves at all. And, yeah, and that's kind of what this question is asking.
You would have to add up the total weight of, you know, the starches or whatever, you know, the sugars in the mash, and then divide that by the diastatic power of the, you know, the of the proportion of the malt you have.
Exactly.
And as long as you're above like 30 to 50, you're probably okay.
As long as you don't overheat something and denature something on accident,
right.
I think
you start getting down into those low numbers, you have to start being careful.
I think Testy might be going to say the same thing I was going to say. What were you going to say?
Well, I actually had a question and have a statement. Is like the diastatic power of like two rows one thing? Say you say 120, 130. What would like say German Pilsner be? And I guess a related question is, do they fill in the gaps left in each other? That is, would the two together provide maybe a higher...
If you had 50% Pilsner malt and you had 50% corn, then that effectively you have half of that 130. So you'd have a diastatic power of the group of like 65.
The only Pilsner malt I use is Durst Turbo Pils, and it runs about 80 dp.
So it's less.
All right, so here's the thing that I note on this. And again, I'm just a practical guy, right? And
you have no theory at all, right?
what I notice from this question is he's talking about chocolate, Crystal 120, Crystal 40. Now those things don't need to be converted. You can actually there's some conversion that can happen, but generally you could just go ahead and steep those, and you don't have to worry about conversion. You'll be just fine.
Right, they're not going to throw a starch haze.
Right, there's very minimal starch that you need to worry about in those. Those have already been
beat to death,
mashed, and the sugar's been crystallized, or it's been burnt to a crisp.
They've been gelatinized.
So don't even worry about those. Those have really no effect on it. The honey malt now that needs to be converted. That hasn't been really converted like the crystal malts. Those get converted at the mash at the maltster. They convert those for you, and you just need to rinse out those sugars, essentially. Honey malt hasn't had that conversion happen. The Munich malt hasn't had that conversion. In that recipe, I know there's very little honey malt, and I know that there's enough Munich in there. I think you'd be okay with that. I think that the Munich, it may take a little while to get conversion, but that Munich and that honey malt will go ahead and convert, and the other grains you don't really need to worry about.
Well, and what's the big risk if you don't convert at all? And right. that's going to be
starches.
That you're going to have a starch haze.
Right.
And
a little lower gravity
you're gonna have a starch haze. You can't fine out a starch haze. You could filter it out, but it clogs filters. So if you end up with a haze that you just can't get rid of, then maybe think about trying to convert them. But if not, then don't worry about it, because you're just trying to extract flavors.
The point I want to emphasize is that look at the total grains that you have, and some of them you don't have to worry about converting them.
Black malt is beyond conversion.
Yeah, exactly. Something like Carafa, they actually mash, convert, and ferment, and it gives like a quarter of 1% of alcohol, and then they boil it again to drive off the alcohol for the Cinnamar coloring extract, and they actually have to mash it and convert it and all that so it becomes beer, so they can actually, under the Reinheitsgebot, add that back to the beer. Do they have to
pay tax on that too?
I bet you they do. But so there is some little starch that can be done in there. But really, look at those types of grains, and the really dark ones, the ones that are crystal malts, crystallized, you can ignore. And then some of them will have the ability to self convert, and those will probably be okay.
If you chew it and it tastes like food, then you probably need to convert it. And if you chew it and it doesn't taste like food, then it probably is past conversion.
Oh, yeah? That's interesting.
I chew malts every day. I just grab a handful out of a bag and go, what's C-17 taste like today?
And And, you know, it would never hurt to throw...
Crystal malt.
It would never hurt to throw in, a little bit of pale malt, because, you're essentially adding just some more enzymes and some more starches that can be converted, and you're pretty much guaranteed at that point to getting your conversion there.
Well, and one of the things I think that's really fun to play with is how long does this conversion take? You know, we talk about mashing for an hour, but if you really do want to push the limits of it, most of the conversion takes place much more quickly. And you know, you probably have 90% conversion in 10 minutes.
In an all-malt mash.
In an all-malt mash, yeah.
Yeah, if you have a portion of adjuncts that are non-enzymatic...
Then it takes longer, right?
Right.
Because it takes a while for the enzymes to find all those starch molecules.
Mm-hmm. Great. All right, what we're going to do, we're going to take another short break. And when we come back, we'll turn to the questions from the live chat room and answer some of those and probably give ourselves a little wrap-up here, do our final run-ins. Back after this.
Brew right. Brew smart. Brew strong. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, Push, the new brewery's looking good.
Thanks, Finn. Piece by piece.
Well, let's fire her up. Whoa! Is that a new kettle?
Yeah, just got it brand new, but paid half price.
What? And that blade scale?
40% off.
The new tap handle?
$5 instead of 13. Got a new regulator for the brew stand, too, but $5 instead of 25.
Dude, where are you stealing all this stuff from?
Where else? The More Beer Deal of the Day.
Announcing the Beer, and More Beer Deal of the Day. Every day, a new fantastic deal from big items to small that will blow you away. Boil kettles, carboy carriers, sterile siphon starters, digital timers. Watch morebeer.com every day for a new deal, and you just might find the item you've been waiting for at a price you cannot believe. Hurry, because stock is limited on most items.
And that sweet Guinness cap, let me guess.
The More Beer Deal of the Day.
Yeah, I knew it. Come on, let's brew something. Find the More Beer Deal of the Day at morebeer.com. Celebrity voices impersonated.
Attention homebrew shop owners. At Firm and Tap, they know you're tired of buying the same old gear that everyone else has. That's why Firm and Tap offers the newest and most cutting-edge brewing equipment known to man. Since 1998, Firm and Tap has been leading the fight against the boring and mundane by offering strange, unique, and just plain smart equipment. Like their stainless stone false bottoms. Never deal with the floating plastic hassle of other false bottoms again. And since they're made from stainless steel, they'll last a lifetime. Firm and Tap's line of copper wort chillers are the best on the market, designed to cool your wort faster and more efficiently than other immersion chillers. They actually invented the equipment to make these chillers not only work great, but look great too. How about a fantastic line of ingredients, including vanilla beans, sorghum extract, blue agave extract, hot bitterness extract, unique wine yeast, green coffee beans, sake kits, all stuff you can't find anywhere else. Firm and Tap carries all the standard products and equipment you need as well, such as all grain systems, stainless hardware, kettles, carbonation zones, you name it, they've got it. Firm and Tap's entire line of products has been helping retail shops meet the demands of their customers for nearly 10 years, and they want to help you too. For more information, see them on the web at fermentap.com or call Jason at 1-800-942-2750. Firm and Tap, better beer through innovation.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
We're back. I'm here with Testy, Colin, John, and myself, Jamel. Justin.
And you got to be kidding me, John Palmer.
What are you doing back there?
I will hang up on you. I don't care if you're the host of this show.
He's a troublemaker.
He's a troublemaker.
He tries to pretend to be, oh, I'm this nice guy. I'm real, well-behaved and intelligent.
And he's got Laffy Taffy in his mouth as he comes back on the air.
No, it was a pretzel. A good beer pretzel.
I oughta. Yeah.
That just didn't fly. That just doesn't fly around here.
So I'm sitting at this convention on hops up in Oregon, and this guy I don't know sits down next to me, and we're sitting going through, you know, a few lectures, and finally he looks over at me and he says, "Do you understand anything about what they're saying?" And I said, "I'm as lost as you, but shut up, because I'm hoping that they give me something I can understand." And it turns out it was John, and we were both lost in this lecture. We were just so far over our heads.
I love the part where the guy had the big molecule model up there, and he goes, "Yeah, you can turn it this way, and you can see that's something."
Yeah, right. And expected everybody to go, "Oh, I get it now." Oh my God, these guys are over our heads. PhD in molecular biology, and they'd still be over your heads. You know,
it was
a great conference. You know, they haven't issued the proceedings yet, though.
I know. I've been waiting for those. I should call.
I've actually contacted Tom Shellhammer about it.
And, what do you say?
That they should be out before the end of the year.
What the hell? You guys done chatting? You know, there's this thing called the telephone you can use. You know, we're using up listener time here.
Hey, we're bored with your enzyme show, okay?
we're bored with all the
Justin,
penis
I
jokes.
Think this combination of hosts is never going to work in the future.
Never.
I think, too rowdy.
Yeah. Two-hour shows, too much brains in the room, and then it gets rowdy on top of that.
Yeah, I need to stick with my own dim-witted comments.
One dim-wit's plenty.
Yeah. We're filling it up here. All right. So we've been talking about enzymes. So, you know, we started out, you know, what is an enzyme? You know, where you find them, how they're accessed, all the different kinds that are available, what they do, and how important they are to the brewing process. Now, even the extract brewers out there, don't forget that enzymes play a big part in the extracts you're getting. So the brewery, and there is a brewery that produces these malt extracts for you, you know, some really excellent malt extracts. They're fantastic. No reason not to use malt extracts. But one of the things that happens is that fermentability is kind of predefined for you. And that's predefined by the enzymes and the temperatures that were used at the extract producer. So you might find one extract that is more fermentable, one that is less. And that's because of the role that the enzymes played in converting the starches and the grains into the sugars, the same way that an all-grain brewer does.
But, of course, you know, we can add enzymes later if we want to change that.
Beano. Yeah, yeah. My daughter... You know, bought me a jar of Beano at the grocery store. Dad, I got you something.
Is this a hint?
Yeah, I know. She's like, it controls the farting. I'm like, oh, thanks.
Hey.
Thanks.
What's nice about having all sons is, you know, they don't care if you fart at all. They really think it's funny. Yeah. When you got daughters, hey, yeah, I can see it.
Yeah, they worry about me farting. Yes. I don't quite understand that.
My 2-year-old daughter thinks it's funny when I fart. So.
Can you play a tune?
No, I can't. I can't do the Star Spangled Banner or anything. You know.
What kind of father are you? All right, so Beano, you can add enzymes right to your extract like Beano
or to your fermentation
or your fermentation. Sure. The thing that I always recommend is adding them, prior to the boil. And you can kind of, you know, allow that to break down the sugars further, and then boil. You denature the enzymes, and
then
stop
you fix
working.
It. Right.
If you add it to your fermenter, it's going
to
go all the way down, and it's going
to
be real dry and thin. So,
but
if
you're looking
for
Bud Light, then that might be a good choice.
Yeah. A light beer.
Well, if you're you're making a big barley wine, and you haven't had much luck getting it to ferment down where you want it, you could be proactive in that way too.
Right. Yeah. And so that's something that the extract brewer can do. Beano tablets. There are commercial enzymes for brewers, right, Colin?
Yeah, I use them once in a while. It's like the deep dark secret. It's like I'm frustrated with the fermentation of a triple IPA or something, and so I sneak some enzymes out of the cellar and don't tell anybody.
So, you know. What are these enzymes? Where do you buy them? Can the average amateur brewer buy them?
You know that you can't yet. But everything that I've had available to me in the brewery has been available to the amateur eventually. So I'm sure now that they're broken down, they used to be only, you know, you buy a 55-gallon drum of enzymes. Mm-hmm. And now I can buy a liter, which mm-hmm. is a more usable amount for me. And soon you'll be able to buy 20 milliliters, which will be a more usable amount for a home brewer. Mm-hmm. So as these things, you know, break down from big industry into my world, they'll continue to break down into the homebrewing world. And the two I use work in the fermenter. So they work at 70 degrees Fahrenheit really well.
And there's no danger of them going too far?
Yeah,
certainly. How do you get them to stop?
You don't. You just let them run all the way to the end.
Well, you could measure your gravity and then crash it when you get to where you want to be, right?
No, because they'll even work at my F40.
Oh, even at 40. Yeah. So your extended logging will be a big problem.
Yeah, right. You know, if you you can bottle condition without adding any more sugar or yeast. Yeah,
yeah. Gotcha. So you can't kill them once they're in there.
No, once they're in there, they go all the way to till there's everything's gone.
Right. Yeah. And I've heard that about the Beano, of course. Yeah, you got it.
Well, but you know what, though? There's some fun, you know, you can add other things that they can't eat, and, you know, maltodextrin you can throw in there.
Gotcha.
And so you can still have some body and mm-hmm. end up with a real dry beer. I mean, it's, you know, it's fun to make a double IPA that starts at, say, 1090 and finishes at 1004 and still has head retention, body and sweetness.
Well, and we were talking about that earlier before the show. We were talking about how, you know, how far a beer attenuates. The finishing gravity actually, it has some play in sweetness, but not all play in sweetness. So you can have a beer that finishes a little lower finishing gravity. Tasty was, he had one beer that finished at 1010. He had the same wort that finished at 1011. And the one that finished at 1011, I believe everyone identified as being drier.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, there's the body component and there's the sweetness component. And that's why you can get a Belgian triple that finishes in the single digits, yet has a real sweetness to it up front and finishes very dry.
Well, and then there's also something that's going on with hops that you and I have talked about, mm-hmm. and there seem, if you add hops late in fermentation, you seem to be able to make esters that have a perceived sweetness,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Fruity kind of sweetness,
right?
And they don't tend to affect the gravity, so you can end up with these low gravities and this strong perceived fruity sweetness,
mm-hmm.
Simply by dry hopping late in fermentation.
Yep.
But the yeast has to be active, and you have to have hops in contact with the yeast.
Yeah, it's a fascinating, very complex, you know, system of things. I don't think any listener should let that frighten them. You know, experiment away and you know, try some of these things, and you know, it's okay. It'll work out. Don't worry. You know, maybe we're getting a little technical on some things, but the general takeaway is that, you know, all this stuff will work. If you're all grain brewer, you just get it wet and get it in the right temperature. Even if you're partial mashing, get it wet, get it in the right temperature. Sure, it's going to be okay.
You know, well, that's the other thing that, you know, one of the things that we've done in these two shows is what we're doing is we're setting the toys in the playground. This is a vast playground of things that we all get to enjoy. And what we're doing is saying the swing set's over there and the slide's over here. And you don't have to play with them if you don't want to. But if you want to, they're there to play with. And I think that's an important thing to remember. There's a lot to learn. I've done more than 600 batches at Downtown Joe's, and I still learn things every day from my batches. So,
and we'll be hanging out in the shrubs, watching you play on the playground, and you know.
Well, that's because you're a pedophile. But
oh, that was just mean. That was just mean. Not mean. All right, so we have people listening live. If you've never listened live, go to thebrewingnetwork.com, click on that chat now button, and you can participate live in the chat as it happens. What do we got going on today, Justin?
A lot of things happening in the chat. I want to give my personal thanks to Colin for coming in here and messing with Jameel a little bit. I like it.
Slapping him around.
Last time Colin shows up.
Really added a lot to the discussion.
Yeah.
He did do that, yes.
I like Colin the way he's able to bring it down to us homebrewers too. I really like your last statement about, you know, we're talking about these things. You can use them, you can not. Your beer's going to be okay. But here they are, you know, if you want to mess with them. I think that's important for people to remember. So for me, as the amateur in the room, I just like hearing you say that. I did have some questions from the chat room. A lot of people hanging out tonight. We've talked about how a lot of the enzyme conversion happens in the first 15 or so minutes of your mash. So how much actually happens after the first 15 or 20 minutes, somebody asked.
Everything that didn't get wet in the beginning. So you look at efficiency when you're starting, when you're looking at that last 40 minutes, it's, you had that dry clump that didn't quite get stirred in really well, mm-hmm. and it starts to get hydrated and it starts to be affected. And so you start looking at your efficiency, and the longer you mash, the more efficient you get, but each minute is diminishing returns. You know.
Okay.
So I'm running now, I run 60 minutes, and I recirculate the whole time. And I don't think I can get any more efficiency out of my system. I'd have to change my equipment to get more efficiency.
So if it's in contact with that hot water, it's done. You're saying that it's everything that was not in contact in the first 15 minutes.
That's what I think. Yeah, when you do the congressworts at you're in the college class and you make a congresswort, it's a 1 liter mash. In 10 minutes, 15 minutes, it's all done.
Okay.
Well, and there's some grains out there where when they do this congress mash, it converts in under a minute. It's done. It's, you know, it's pretty much, yeah, as soon as the grain hits the water, it's converted.
There's a lot of factors. There's the diastatic power of the malt. There's the modification of the malt. There's the grist ratio. And as Colin and Jamil are saying, you know, in the Congress mash is one thing. In someone's brew system, it's another thing. And one reason we can recommend an hour as a kind of a baseline time is because we're trying to make sure that there's some cushion there, that there's enough time for that mash to convert. I've done mashes that have been, you know, have adjuncts in them. I've done them with pale malt, which has lower diastatic power than, say, two row. And I've had, you know, mashes that I can tell through iodine tests and cloudiness and so on and smell, they're just not done after an hour. You got to stir, heat them up a little more, keep going, let them go. I think homebrewers need to understand that when they hear somebody saying, "Oh, a mash converts in 15 minutes," that's an ideal situation. That's a laboratory mash, and there's probably factors going on there that they're not aware of.
Absolutely. You know, when I suggested it, that's one of the things I'm just trying to remind people is these enzymes are really active, and it takes the skill and experience of the brewer to do exactly what you did. You checked the clarity, you smelled the mash, and you likely even tasted it, and you came to a conclusion, this mash isn't complete. And that's something that in a brewery you do just as a matter of course. And you might look at it after 45 minutes and say, you know what, this one's done. I'm not wasting 15 minutes of my day. Or you might look at it after an hour and go, you know what, I'm going to go have a cup of coffee with the cute girl down the street because this one needs more time.
All right, I have another one from another homebrewer about mash temperatures and the time it takes. This homebrewer is targeting, let's say, 152 Fahrenheit mash temperature. He says, after I add my strike water, I find that the mash is actually 156, so I add cold water to bring it down to 152, but it takes about 15 minutes to get there. So he wants to know, what's happened to my lower temperature enzymes? Are they dead? Did I kill them? Is it too late?
No, there's still a good portion of those left. The whole denaturing thing is, you got to remember, this isn't like electricity. Where you flip it on, flip it off. These are organic organisms. They're not alive, but these are natural processes, and so they happen by half lives. And you know, the reaction has a peak and then it tapers off. And 156. It's too hot for beta, and so you will denature in 15 minutes. You know, maybe 40% of your beta amylase, but there's still going to be a good portion left. as it cools down, that's still going to be, you know, that won't denature because you've cooled it down. It'll work fine. The other thing to know about enzymes is the hotter they get, the closer they get to denaturing temperature, the faster they work. So, you know, they're coming up on their denaturing temp and they're starting to be denatured, but at the same time they're processing twice as much starch as they would if it were, you know, 5 or 10 degrees cooler.
The rule of thumb they gave us in school was for every 10 degrees Celsius you doubled the speed of an enzyme.
Well, here's a practical brewing tip for everybody. If you find yourself, you mash in and you end up at 165, right? And you figure, and you don't notice it for 15 minutes, and you're like, oh my God, what did I do? Do I need to throw all this away? You don't. Get yourself another pound of domestic 2-row or, you know, 6-row if you got it. Throw that in there. You know, grind it up, throw it in there. Millet, throw it in there, and then stir it around or recirculate, and there's going to be enough enzymes in there. It may take a little longer, but there'll be enough enzymes in there to fully convert that mash for you. You know, get the temperature down, then add this in at whatever temperature it is you want. If you're concerned about it, you toss that in there, and I guarantee you it'll convert everything. It may take some time. It may take a little bit of stirring if you got, like, let's say you got 40 pounds of grain in there, and you got a pound of 2-row. Eventually, the enzymes will make it happen. It's again, the enzymes don't get used up. They can keep on working, and once everything.
Once the wort is clear, it's converted.
Right.
And that's your final test. I mean, you can do an iodine test, but you know what? If you can fill a pint glass with the wort and it's clear, then it's converted.
So don't freak out if that happens to you. Just make sure you have some grain still available to you that you can just mill up and toss in there, and that will resolve any problem you have with too high a mash temperature.
All right, a couple more questions to get through. This might be a stump the chemist question for you guys. Someone wants to know, he had heard that there's an enzyme that helps the precursors to that clove phenol in Weizens, which I guess, though, is a yeast thing. Does anybody know about an enzyme that helps that happen? Have you guys heard about that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. You answer this one, though, Colin. I'm not an expert on wheat beers.
I hate clove flavor, so if I knew of that enzyme, I'd figure out how to denature it and get rid of it.
Jamil knows it.
Yeah, I don't know the name of it.
Oh, but you know what he's talking
yes.
about? And there is, and it's a malt enzyme?
Yeah, I guess it's something that, there's a certain temperature rest that you do, and it all these precursors that are considered, critical. And wheat has more of these. I can't think of what it is right now.
All right.
Well, I guess the beginning of all of this is phenols are really common in malt. So the fact that there's a way to get them to survive into the beer isn't surprising in any way, shape, or form.
Well, and this and some interaction with the yeast
converts them into the chemical.
But personally, I wouldn't worry about it. I think along with Colin, do single infusion mashes on everything, wheat beers, everything, and you get plenty of the clove and all that other stuff.
I only do single infusion, and I've done a lot of experiments as a home brewer with rests and decoction and all of that, and you know what?
Single infusion. Not even worth the time.
Nope. Single infusion gives me a better beer in less time, and why am I wasting my time?
Yep.
The maltster has done his job so well. Why am I wasting my time trying to redo it?
Yeah, don't forget that's part of the mashing process is what the maltster does. Actually, you're just kind of continuing the process with your mash.
All right. Did you guys mention bulk enzymes in the program a bit earlier?
Yeah, we did. We talked a little bit about it.
What do they look like? Someone wants to know what they look like. Is that a powder? Is it a big bag of powder? What are bulk enzymes?
I've gotten it as a white liquid, and I've gotten it as a powder.
Okay.
I've gotten it both ways.
All right. Just be wanting to know that.
What did you say, Jamil?
He's pissed that I wasn't listening.
No, I wouldn't. It's more going off the railroad track.
When you're talking about
white liquids, white powders. Yeah.
Yes. All right. And the last question.
And they're usually bacteria derived, I should mention. So they're actually growing a bacteria to extract these enzymes from it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But they are from malt, or is they getting from
something? No, no, they're grown. They're actually bacteria derived,
like underwear derived bacteria.
Right. Yeah, right. You know, they,
so these are good bugs. They don't sour the beer. They just eat the.
Well, the bacteria is long gone. Oh, all they did was grow the bacteria in the lab and then take and the extract enzymes. The enzyme away from
gotcha.
It.
Yeah.
All right, I've got one more on top question, on topic question, and then I'm going to allow one slightly off topic question for the day. The last on topic about Beano, you guys are talking about adding that. Does pasteurization denature Beano? Somebody had asked.
Yes,
it does. Okay.
There's a certain temperature.
There is a way to denature Beano.
And the
pasteurization of beer though is really cold.
Well, yeah, it depends on the temperature of pasteurization. Pasteurization can happen at low temperatures, it can happen at high temperatures, so if you get hot enough, yes.
Yes, absolutely, if you get it hot enough.
So,
but I don't know if Budweiser gets their beer hot enough.
Yeah, probably not.
You know, and they flash pasteurize, they have a big tunnel pasteurizer down here, and they actually put their beers in the bottle, seal the bottle, and then pasteurize the whole package.
Yeah, I wouldn't do the enzyme thing unless, you know, you were going to boil. I would do it before the boil.
Unless you want dry.
Super dry beer, yeah.
You know, if you're looking for cure and light, then, you know, put Beano in the fermenter.
Make your own utopias.
All right, we do like to keep things on topic, but this, since enzymes have so much to do with mash temperature, I'll allow this last question for the day from the chat room. This person wants to know, hey, tomorrow I'm going to try out his new RIMS system. He says, I want to do a Weizen, and he's going to use the Weinstephan 3068 yeast. What temperature rests should I target, is his question. Anybody want to tackle the rest? Palmer?
Yeah, I've got
152.
But yeah, 148 single infusion.
dang. I've got Schneider Weiss's presentation here on their Weiss beer. And I know he talked about it, but I don't think he wrote it down.
We're not doing anything. You got time to look at it. Go ahead.
Okay,
yeah, go ahead. It's off topic anyway.
Yeah.
We were actually going to strip Jameel and figure out what color his underwear were while you were waiting. So
none. I go commando all the time.
None more color.
For
a distinct phenolic note, you do a rest at about 113 F for a little over 10 minutes.
So I'd call that an acid rest, right?
Yeah. 113 F for about 10 minutes.
It's like isn't it the peruvic acid or something that is the thing for wheat beers and the clove and all that, something like that.
As you go
peruvic
longer,
acid rest or something,
you start accentuating the. Well, so you drop the esters.
I mean, you got sitting there. Somebody, you know, Google. Come on. let's get the answer to this.
I had somebody want to know. I tried to look it up.
So that's it? Just that one rest is the one that
That's the only one he mentions.
Okay.
I think
they do like a 113. They'll do like a 120 something or 130. Don't they do the 30, 40, 50 type of thing? Centigrade?
It could be. I don't know.
So, I can't
find it here on this sheet.
The traditional German rests are
20, 30, 40, 50, right?
Yeah, it's like 60, or 30, and then they drop the 20, I think, and so it's like 30, 40, 50, 60.
Okay. All right.
And then maybe for wheat beers, they do the 20, so 20, 30, 40, 50. And again, you would think, oh, all right, so there's like some magic about, because when you're looking at these numbers in Fahrenheit, you're thinking it's like,
150,
113, 121 and a half, right. And you're thinking, oh, there must be some real science behind this. It's like, no, the guys were like looking at their thermometer going, okay, well, we'll do a 20, we'll do a 30, we'll do a 40, we'll do a 50. It's like we would do, we'd call it like, oh, 120, 130. So there's, I don't think there's a whole lot of magic in there, like they determine the barley whisperer type of thing. That's nonsense, and don't romanticize that.
Well,
it was convenient as to what the thermometer read, remember.
And the times are kind of important too, though.
Right.
You wouldn't want to go stopping at 30 C for 2 hours.
Right, exactly.
That would make a really bad beer.
You go through just a few minutes on each, like 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And that's the other thing. It's not you know, 6 minutes and 32 seconds. It's, oh, we'll do 10 minutes on this and 15 minutes on that. And it's, again, it's a general ballpark. It is not some magical, mystical thing that, you know, people are like, oh, no, you got to do this in order to make a good wheat beer or a good, you know, or you got to decoction mash. That's all just not true. It's not, you know, the simple single infusion nowadays will get you pretty much everything you need. If you want to do all that other stuff, that's great. It can be entertaining. It can be fun. But, you know, there's not something very, you know, that was figured out. They didn't set the measure
of Celsius based on brewing.
they just kind of winged their brewing based on, you know, remembering, instead of having to remember it was 12, you know, or 21 Celsius, it was 20, and they just kind of, you know, hit these round numbers. So,
and you know, another really important thing to keep in mind is something that I learned the first day I was brewing with Brian Hunt, and he said, you know, all we do is make food for yeast. It's yeast that makes beer.
Mm-hmm.
So just make the best food you can, and the yeast will do their job, and you know, it's yeast that makes beer. We pretend like we do, but we don't.
All right. That is it from the chat today, and again, thank you for joining us on short notice. I think come November, we will be on a normal Brew Strong schedule. You will know when we're doing the live shows, and you can be here with us in the chat room asking your questions. And, of course, as Jamil said, send all of your topics and different questions to brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com. The rest is up to you.
Jamil, did you notice that I didn't wear any shoes today?
Oh, put those away.
Yes, I did. You'll disgust Justin. Justin can't handle the foot thing.
No. Put them down.
They were way better than my work shoes. So.
I think you need like a no alcohol policy here in the studio.
Oh.
It just gets out of control. All right, so let me try and wrap up what we've done here. Other than the screwing around and kicking the host in the junk.
Oh, that was the most fun, yeah.
We talked about, you know, what an enzyme is. It's kind of like a key that unlocks the sugars from the starches and makes them you know, into those sugary things that the yeast can eat and make your beer. Without the enzymes, you could not make beer. The enzymes are in the barley. They're like a perfect little package, and the maltsters kind of got things prepped for you, and you grind them up or mill them and put in the mash, and they go ahead at a certain temperature and convert into different sugars, and then even convert other starches like rice or corn into maltose as well, or other sugars that the malt enzymes can make. And this also is happening before you get your extract. The extract manufacturer is doing this for you and kind of locking in that fermentability. Of course, you can change that through the addition of other enzymes. So something like a commercial enzyme that Colin has secreting around every once in a while, or something, you know, as common as Beano, will do it. And it'll break down those carbohydrates for you. And unless you want a really dry beer, you want to do that before the boil. The boil will denature it. Denaturing the enzymes, or, you know, busting up these proteins into little bits so they can't act anymore. It's like a key. If you took a key off your keychain and you smashed into little bits and tried to open your door lock with it, wouldn't work, right? Same thing with the enzymes. So that stops them when they get hot enough. What else?
We also learned what makes a hormone.
Colin, what has happened? I don't know.
Don't leave dead airspace. I'm just telling you, just don't leave dead airspace.
There's something infectious in the studio. I don't know what it is. Yeah. And
don't forget the protein enzymes either.
Very good point. Thank you, John. That it's not only you know, sugars; it's other things like, you know, acids and proteins, and you know, that take the proteins and chop them up even smaller. You know, the head forming proteins. If you do this too long, you can end up with you know, a really pour head on the beer, things like that. So there's a lot of complex things about enzymes, but I think we got a pretty good overview of what enzymes are and kind of the roles that they play in the brewing process. And I can guarantee you on future shows we are going to cover, you know, more specifics about mash temperatures, pHs, how that affects the enzymes, how that affects the final beer, and things like that. We want to kind of give a starting kind of education about enzymes before we really got to dig into other aspects of enzymes.
Yeah. And in all candor, I can say that if you are interested in more information about enzymes, read How to Brew. Because it's in there in chapter 14.
And see, I thought you would throw in like a Brewing Classic Styles.
I thought he'd make up for it.
Yeah, I thought he would, in all candor, you know, Brewing Classic Styles. No, he goes to How to Brew. I tell you, you know, what am I working with here?
I didn't put anything on enzymes in Brewing Classic Styles.
Yeah, I love John Palmer.
I didn't
Palmer.
Even see the word in there.
That's a funny man right there. F you, Jameel.
Buy How to Brew. You know, you find it in the Brewing Network store.
It's good thing we check our guns at the door here.
I'm at a loss for words.
I got you in the balls again.
That wasn't what I meant.
You know, I guess I'll return for another show. I'm not really sure. You know,
and
I
get thought that contract
was,
out.
I thought I wouldn't get like the police, you know, jab in the groin every once in a while. But apparently, I get it here too. It must be me, not all you folks. I'll tell you,
no,
if you're listening, you know, there's a lot of other great programming on the Brewing Network. Check it out. There's the Sunday Session, which is really my favorite. There's the Jameel Show, which is all about styles with my good friend John Plisse, and there's some great things you can buy in the Brewing Network store that help support the Brewing Network, as well as subscriptions and things like that. If you can help us out by doing that, that would be wonderful. It keeps programming like this live and available to you on a regular basis. Until then, brew strong.
Brew strong, everybody. Thanks, Jameel.